Hey everybody, this week on Flareon Films, we're talking about 2001 Space Odyssey.
Hit the music!
Hi everybody, I'm Michael Flaherty.
And I'm Colleen Flaherty.
And we're talking about 2001 A Space Odyssey. I'm going to read the description of this movie. After discovering a mysterious artifact buried beneath the lunar surface, mankind sets off on a quest to find its origins with help from intelligent supercomputer HAL 9000.
Is that what the movie's about?
That sounds like a really fun buddy comedy. The robot's just like the snarky sidekick.
And one thing you missed, this movie's from 1968, mm-hmm. So 1 year before we're on the moon. So Kubrick goes into the boardroom and he's like, hey man, I got a movie for you. We got space fever in America. What about a fun twisted and cool sci-fi movie? Like, yes.
Let's introduce our special guest, David Padbury. Thank you so much for joining us.
This is my very good friend, David. David, say hello to the audience at home.
Hi, audience at home.
This is your favorite movie of all time, is that correct?
I mean, it's no Gladiator.
So this is your second favorite
movie. It's up there,
okay. Let's talk about our initial impressions.
Yes, Michael, had you seen this film before?
Super long time ago, but I forgot there was a floating baby, so it must have been a long time ago, you know?
Sure.
So it's been a while.
That's one of the more memorable bits.
You'd think that would stick, but it somehow didn't. So I don't enjoy the film per se.
Right.
But like, I mean, we've seen our fair share of terrible films.
Right.
And like, this is bad, but sometimes you gotta appreciate a floating baby in space.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's so weird. Like, I was laughing.
Yeah. So I had seen this movie once a long time ago with my friend David because he insists it is his favorite movie.
It's his second favorite. It's up there.
And so I remember seeing it a long time ago and getting kind of bored. I did remember the baby,
kind of.
And then my friend David has this habit of getting really drunk and showing people the first 20 minutes of this film. So I've seen that a few times.
The first 20 minutes. I like to see how far people will sit through it.
It's just a test.
Just wait for it. And just keep saying that. Like, I did it too. Yeah. You made it like half an hour.
So you don't really like it so much as a movie. More as like a prank.
Yeah. And they're like, wait for what? And I just wait.
But what I will say about this movie is like, totally belongs on the AFI, but I never ever want to watch it again.
Because of just the technical?
Because the technical aspect, because it's so beautiful, because of its cultural impact, like it's all there.
Yeah, would we have Star Wars if we didn't have this movie?
Would Alexa look the way it does without this movie? Would the Simpsons parodies be so good?
David, you want to say anything more about how you feel about this film before we go on to our first segment?
Sure. So I understand why not many people may like this. It is probably one of the most pretentious movies ever made, mm-hmm. which I kind of really like it for. I really like it as a sci-fi film. It's one of the few ones that really doesn't focus on like, oh, there's aliens trying to kill us, like Star Wars, Independence Day stuff. And there's a lot more.
But the robot's trying to kill them.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he's trying to kill humans, but that's a robot.
Right, not an alien.
Exactly, no aliens that's trying to kill us.
Yeah.
It's just a much kind of deeper look at kind of science fiction, and it's much more in keeping with like R.C. Clarke's novels and Ivanov and those guys.
Is based on an Arthur C. Clarke book or short story?
So it's actually based on a short story called The Sentinel. Which R.C. Clarke wrote in the 50s, which was about a pyramid that was found in the moon. And that's kind of where that story ends. And then Kubrick read that, used it for the basis of like, hey, we should make a movie. And this kind of spiraled from there. I mean, they had...
But there are books.
Yeah, so while this movie was being made, R.C. Clarke was also...
Look at how angry Bam Piper
basically
Sam
turned the screenplay into a novel.
Okay.
However, Kubrick and R.C. Clarke kind of parted ways during the making of the film. They actually started working on this in 1964. so like a full 4 years before the movie actually came out. So the actual novel that was published ended up being quite different to the thing that Kubrick ended up putting out.
Okay.
Like the novel itself was actually, rather than going to Jupiter, had everyone going to Saturn, I believe.
So if anyone's wondering why David's ruining Sam's segment, despite us doing this podcast for over 2 years, he has never listened to an episode. So he does not know what's coming next.
Let's go to our first segment. Bam.
Time for Sam.
Our cousin Sam's going to tell us some facts about the film that we may or may not know.
May or may not have just heard recently.
Yeah.
Having just completed his film, Dr. Strangelove, Stanley Kubrick decided to turn to extraterrestrials for his film, next film. When he brought the idea up to the vice president of his production company, Roger Karras, Karras suggested that Kubrick connect with science fiction writer Arthur Clarke. C. Clarke.
His name is also Arthur Clarke.
That's Mr. Arthur Clarke.
Karras sent a cable to Clarke that read, Stanley Kubrick, Dr. Strangelove, Path of Glory, etc. Interested in doing a film on ETS? Stop. Are you interested? Query. Thought you were recluse? Stop. Clarke replied with his own cable stating, frightfully interested in working with Infant Terrible. Stop. Contact my agent. Stop. What makes Kubrick think I'm a reclusive query? Clarke and Kubrick, I can't say the name, I'm sorry, started on a story that was based on Clarke's short story called The Sentinel, which he had written for the BBC.
That is so interesting.
short story competition. Cool. But it was not accepted. So basically, he showed up and Clarke was like, here are six of my short stories, and Kubrick read them all and then picked The Sentinel. To have the freedom of pure storytelling, the men decided to write a novel of the story first. According to Clarke, this was more or less the way it worked out, though towards the end, novel and screenplay were written simultaneously? Thank you. With feedback in both directions. Thus, I rewrote some sections after seeing the movie Rushes, a rather expensive method of literary creation which few other authors can have enjoyed.
So I think that's really interesting because so this is a little a lot of the one-star reviews said something like they were pissed that people would tell them to like the movie, and then they'd say, well, if you'd read the book, you'd understand. So that's weird that there was kind of a diversion between the book and movie when they're like, oh, the book really informs how great the movie is.
Mm-hmm. So people who kind of like what David was saying. So the novel was published a few months after the release of the movie. So the men were very different with their artistic styles. And it's pretty obvious when you kind of see the book and movie, Kubrick was really big into mystery and open-end questions.
And colors.
He has stated, quote, how much would we appreciate Mona Lisa today if Leonardo had written at the bottom of the canvas, this lady is smiling slightly because she has rotten teeth.
Oh my God.
Or because she's hiding a secret from her lover. It would shut off the viewer's appreciation and shackle him to the reality other than his own. I don't want that to happen in 2001.
Oh my God. Can I tell you something, how dumb I am? If it had not been explained to me, I would not have gotten that aliens were involved in this movie. I didn't get that.
What do you mean?
So, like,
where do you think the monolith came from?
I don't know where the monolith came from. The future? Like, I don't know. That's not clear to
me. Doesn't even
well, actually, that brings me nicely into my next fact.
It also doesn't matter. You're right, Mike.
As this was a film about space, what they needed next was some aliens.
Don't know why that's funny. Sorry.
Kubrick had many grand ideas that the budget wasn't really okay with, so he went to astrophysicist Carl Sagan for inspiration. Sagan later wrote, I argued that the number of individually unlikely events in the evolutionary history of man was so great that nothing like us is ever likely to evolve again anywhere in the universe. I suggested that an explicit representation of an advanced extraterrestrial being was bound to have at least an element of falseness about it, and that the best solution would be to suggest rather than explicitly display the extraterrestrials. Kubrick did not like this, and he tried a lot of crazy ideas, some involving ballerinas and spotted outfits, but finally he agreed.
Oh my God.
Like Dalmatian ballerinas?
It was like a weird, I can't even get into it.
Polka dot man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
you know.
Oh, no, it aliens. Got, like, far along, and then finally they're like, we just need to rein this back in. Kubrick,
right, for a more reasonable film.
Kubrick also wanted to make sure the science in the movie was as accurate as it could be.
Why are you laughing?
It's just floating space, baby. Why would that really happen like that?
He hired Harry Lang and Frederick Ordway, both previous NASA heads, as technical consultants. Ordway would say Kubrick wanted to make certain that every special effect shot would be completely convincing, yielding a realism never before accomplished in motion pictures. This is why this movie's on the list, guys. Many pieces of the spaceship are actually space worthy.
Wow.
Whoa.
That is a cool fact.
Filming started on December 29th in 1965. It was filmed entirely in England, close to Kubrick's home. Didn't he also
It's the same, yeah.
Yeah. As soon as I read that, I'm like, you get Clockwork Orange because you also didn't want to go far away from your home.
Yep.
And it was almost entirely shot in studio. There's only one scene that was filmed on, quote, location, which was when the moon watcher throws his tool into the pile of bones. Didn't watch the movie.
Sure.
Oh, right.
Moon watcher throws his...
Yeah, it's one of the apes.
Why would that be on location?
He has a name.
They had to show the sky, I think.
Yeah, I don't actually think it was like on location, like in a desert.
No. It was literally like half a mile outside the studio.
Oh, okay.
They had to put it on a platform so they could shoot it at an angle so you couldn't see the cars in the background.
Yes, this is the opening like desert shot.
No one can hear you right now. Yeah.
Kubrick was greatly inspired by a 28-minute animated documentary from the 1960s called Universe. It was meant to be an awe-inspiring look at what it was like sailing through the universe. He loved the film so much, he hired Douglas Rain, the narrator of Universe, to be the voice of HAL 9000. And he hired the optical effects artist Wally Gentleman for the special effects.
Wally Gentleman? Was that a real name?
That's a real name. I honest to God, that's the only reason I picked that fact.
New favorite part.
Wally Gentleman. Speaking of special effects, this movie is most famous for its 205 incredible special effects shots. Unfortunately, it's really hard to explain the technical way they did all these effects, especially the Stargate. I seriously read like 3 descriptions on how they use slit scan photography, and I still cannot describe it. So... there are lots of books and videos purely dedicated to the special effects in this film, and this is your first homework assignment from me. Go do your own research. I can describe one special effect, though. Kubrick spent months with his effect technicians trying to come up with a convincing effect for the floating pen. They tried many attempts, but none were successful until finally they stuck the pen with newly invented double stick tape to a sheet of glass and then just put it in front of the camera. You can actually see the shuttle attendant literally pull at it when she grabs it.
That's it.
That is funny.
I was like trying to figure out, I'm like, is it string? But how did she pull it? And so it's tape. It's taped to glass. Wow. Okay.
Damn.
As Hal powers down, he sings Daisy Bell, or more commonly known as A Bicycle Built for Two. This is an old vaudeville song, but it also is a technology Easter egg, if I'm using that phrase correctly. Daisy Bell was the first song ever programmed into a computer to be played back using speech synthesis. It was first accomplished on an IBM 7094 in 1960.
Very cool.
Cool.
Kubrick would say of this film, it's basically a visual, nonverbal experience that hits the viewers basically. At an inner level of consciousness, boy. Just as music does or painting.
Oh my God.
In fact, the first dialogue isn't heard until 25 minutes into the film.
Is,
thus,
ooh, not dialogue?
No, it's not words.
Oh, okay.
Thus, music was a very important part of this movie. Kubrick would hire composer Alex North, who he'd previously worked with on creating the music for Spartacus to score the film. North composed the full score, but Kubrick abandoned it during post-production and decided to use classical music instead. North would not find out about this until the premiere.
No.
Oh, that's
sucks. Wait, what about the weird screamy thing? Did he do that?
No, he did not.
That was a Hungarian composer.
It was a Hungarian composer that does the weird screamy stuff.
But there is a CD released of the score that came out in 1993. So
is it weird?
I haven't listened to it.
It's weird.
David, have you listened to it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not very interesting. That's what he said.
The movie premiered on April 2nd, 1968 in Washington, D.C. Apparently on leaving the theater, Rock Hudson loudly said, "Will someone tell me what the hell this is about?"
Rock, I get you. I see you. And I agree.
The premiere had an additional 19 minutes of film that Kubrick removed after the showing. It was thought that the 19 minutes were destroyed. However, I read somewhere that 17 minutes of it were found in a salt mine in Kansas in 2010.
Thank God, because I need more time.
Take this head as you will. Although it was a hit with the critics, it was a little slower getting momentum in the box office. Rumor has it that theaters started knowing an increase with the number of young adults attending the film and enthusiastically watching the Stargate sequence while under the influence of psychedelic drugs.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
It would then gain almost a cult classic following. This film would go on to be nominated for 4 Academy Awards, winning 1. It was nominated for, but did not win, Best Director, Best Original Screenplay, Best Production Design.
It would win Best Effects.
Best Visual Effects.
Yeah. They earned that one.
For sure.
I was going to get so mad if they got the editing Oscar.
This film's on 2 other AFI lists. Coming in at number 78 on the top 100 quotes is...
I'm afraid I can't do that, Dave, or open the pod door.
Open the pod door. Pod bay doors, Hal.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
And coming in at number 13 on your top 100 villains is Hal 9000.
He is bad.
And your question of the week, which is also my final fact. In the film, Hal 9000 was, quote, born on January 12th, 1992. However, in the book, he was born in what year?
Whoa.
So what year was he born in the movie?
1992.
Ooh.
Okay. I got it.
All right. My answer is 2000.
My answer is 1987.
David?
98.
1998. The correct answer is 1997.
Ooh.
Wait, Clark, who's closer?
Well,
you are.
Well, what was your answer?
1987. I thought maybe it would be like a 87. Fun Orwell reference or something.
Clark and Kubrick.
Oh, 1985 is that book. God damn it. Damn it.
Clark and Kubrick disagreed on Hal's birthday as Kubrick wanted Hal to be the age of a child for more of an emotional impact. Oh, in 1997, Robert Ebert threw a birthday party for Hal 9000 in Urbana, Illinois, where Hal was born. He invited both Clark and Kubrick. Although Clark made an appearance, Kubrick declined, stating they had missed Hal's birthday back in 92.
And that was BAM.
Time for Sam.
Now we're going to go to our next segment, which is called Critics Corner, where we sort of hear what the critics had to say about the movie at the time or currently.
Right.
Yeah.
Michael, you want to start us out?
Yeah. This is from Bilgri Ebruri. The film is a journey through outer space, but it is also a journey through cinematic space. It conjures the future by making you sit through its vision of the future, spending time just being in it.
Oh, boy. This is a movie for smart people to watch and wonder why dummies like me don't appreciate it. It felt like a 30-minute story stretched into a week of space shots and loud orchestra music,
yeah.
Says Blake, an Amazon customer.
Frankly, 30 minutes is being generous.
Right?
Dave, you want to read one?
Sure.
Well, you have to be into the microphone as well.
I shall go and see it again as soon as possible, for one thing is clear. Man has shrunk space, but Kubrick has expanded the cinema.
Think about that.
Oh my gosh.
Here's one from Connor, an Amazon customer. It is the cinematic equivalent of NyQuil. Like most of the snobs who ride this movie's dick, it likes to think it is more important and deep than it actually is. The film has virtually no plot and no real reason for existing.
This is from Antonio Cizan of The Catholic Reporter. A film of such symbolic and visceral power as 2001 invites various interpretations. Like a prism, you can turn at different angles, each revealing a new facet.
Oh, that's so true.
David, you want to read Great One, another Amazon customer?
Great One. With an 8.
The only positive is the AI character Hal, but even as that was not done well, 4 to 5 minutes to die is just dumb and unnecessary. When it said, "I can feel my mind going," I was thinking, yeah, me too.
Yeah, that's good. Great one. Here's from Lee Patch. Director Stanley Kubrick's amazing marriage of music and images, seen at its absolute best in the space ballet of the capsule docking to the strains of Strauss-Bu-Danube Waltz, points to what we can achieve as a species when we put our minds to it.
Wow, that makes you think. Huh?
Makes you think, man.
Moral of the story, don't mess with big black rectangles.
That's true. They're not.
Even 30 years ago, I bet people had to walk away from this super dull 15-minute lapses of nothing going on. P.S. I wonder if when they released the movie, it came with a complimentary hit of LSD? P.P.S. I still have no clue what the movie was about. I'm going to go and find ways to gain back my 2 hours and 25 minutes that I lost and the 5 minutes writing this review.
Wow.
Says Jacqueline, Amazon customer.
Great. That was a good segment.
So this is our next segment, fan favorite.
Fan favorite.
It's called favorite part, least favorite part. Michael, what was your favorite part?
Probably the same as everyone's favorite part. Just the effects are really great.
Yeah.
They weren't all the best, but just overall, I mean, every shot in space is really good. All
really
the fun
gorgeous.
Zero gravity space, all the sets. I mean, did kind of look 60s, you know, sometimes.
Yeah, there was a stupid part where they're on the moon and they're just walking normally. I'm like, why would they do that? And I'm like, oh, yeah, no one's been on the moon. They don't know. That's kind of neat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just thought there were so many scenes, like there were 100 scenes in the movie that could be a movie poster. It was just beautiful. But a little... David, what's your favorite part of this movie?
Well, probably a similar thing. The scenes of, particularly like the shuttle coming to land on the moon, overplayed by Strauss's Blue Danube. Just absolutely stunning. Like, it goes on for like 6 minutes for no real reason, but it's just absolutely beautiful.
Yeah. Well, let's reverse it. David, what's your...
But also, besides the realism, I mean, the silly just two-color slit shot effect, you know, for 10 minutes that goes on. Like, it's not... deep, you know, not very meaningful, but it is very pretty.
Yeah.
It's a nice looking shot.
Yeah. It's like, am I watching Tron or?
When they just fly over the mountains and they just invert the colors, like that's less impressive. I'm like, you don't.
They literally do that for 3 minutes.
Like I can do
three minutes of inverted colors.
Like I know
colors.
They didn't have Photoshop, but like.
They just put a filter on a camera.
Right.
It's not that interesting.
Right.
I do wonder what they would do now.
Like, right.
Yeah.
I don't think it would even
a 10-minute Stargate scene. What would that look like?
It wouldn't even be remarkable now. It's like, oh, it's just computer shit. That's what people would say.
Yeah. Or a kaleidoscope.
But it was impressive back then. I'm still impressed.
So, David, what's your least favorite part of this film?
My least favorite? I honestly, like most, still struggle with the ending.
As opposed to the beginning or the middle?
Yeah, the bit where they actually try to bring meaning to what's just happened. So particularly when he arrives in a hotel room and then there's a floating baby. I first saw this film when I was like 15, and I'd read a whole bunch of R.C. Clarke before it. And his novels are kind of like this. They don't really give you many answers, but they take you through this wonderful journey describing like magnificent things. So they're kind of fun to read. And it got into, well, when I first watched 2001, like I was sure there must be some real reason for this, and I just wasn't really getting what the ending really was. Then as I grew up and started reading bits about 2001, particularly that story that like they spent ages trying to come up with a way of like betraying the aliens but couldn't, and in the end Kubrick was just like, fuck it, just put him in a hotel room, floating baby, job done. All the nerds would be guessing about that for decades.
Yeah.
So I kind of also appreciate that in some respects now, that he did just say like, fuck it, let's just not portray it. But yeah, I find that difficult.
Yeah. I mean, my least favorite's probably everybody's least favorite part. The pacing, the pretension, hard to pay attention to. But can I also say, just for kind of lost causes, or like, I thought the middle had... So I thought the beginning and the end were pretentious nonsense. The middle was kind of like a good, straightforward sci-fi film if it wasn't so slow. If we didn't have to watch literally 5 minutes of a ship docking in a bay. Like, I kind of like this computer slowly killing people. Like, that's kind of a cool... I'm into that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Maybe I'm just a dummy.
Yeah, there's some good about it, like, not from the sense like, oh, it was slow, therefore really deep and interesting, but it was slow and did make me feel like, oh, I feel like I'm kind of there. You know, it does give it some sort of groundedness.
Sure. Yeah, well, so. What's your least favorite part?
Ooh, just, so the story would be bad.
Are there any characters in this movie?
In the middle bit.
Yeah, but like, do they grow? Are they interesting?
The scientist who goes up to the obelisk. And is that what it's called? The monolith.
Monolith.
Yeah. Yeah.
Heywood Floyd.
Thanks. Yeah. So I guess I haven't landed on anything particular.
I also didn't think the actors were great, but they were fine, right? Yeah. That's what I mean. It's like one of the greatest films of all time, and the actors are fine.
Yeah, nothing really stuck out as like angry just because I knew what I was getting into. Right. Like, I knew it would take an hour, but it's like, well, I'll just look at some pretty colors, and I did. So,
you know, job done.
I wasn't that upset. So now we're going to walk through the plot of this film. I'll start off with the opening paragraph here.
Dave, this is the part where we have our intern summary. We go through it.
Our film opens with 5 minutes of blackness. Oh, yeah.
5 minutes.
I was like, this is the movie, right? I had to pause it. I'm like, yeah, it's okay. It's still working.
TV's broken.
Blackness and discordant music. Then a beautiful shot of the moon and earth with awesome music. Then an odd sequence in the long ago times with apes and a monolith and going apeshit. Soon after, they begin using tools.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes David likes to listen to the soundtrack around, and the beginning is like, just like this weird, like low pitched.
David,
screaming.
Do you want to do an impression of the music?
The orchestral screaming.
Yeah. Doesn't sound that different though. That is kind of what it is.
But like for 5 minutes, so David will just play it, and it's so disconcerting. You're just walking through the house, like, it's like, isn't this beautiful?
I mainly do that for you to enjoy.
Oh, thank you. Flash forward to the future. Well, our past, but you get it. It's 2001. And we have a beautiful sequence of a spaceship approaching a space station. We meet Dr. Heywood Floyd at the space station waiting on a layover on his way to the moon. Dr. Floyd makes a phone call home to his inexplicably British daughter, who is Kubrick's daughter, I think.
Oh, that's awesome.
I don't know why that bothered me, because so his daughter's British, he's American. And then he later is talking to scientists and he's like, you should come hang out with us if you're in the States. So why does she have a British accent? It's nonsense.
I did think it was a fantastic betrayal of a child. Like,
right, just
like, how you doing? Like, she's not an actress.
Yeah, that was. She did seem like a real kid instead of, yeah. Then he bumps into a group of Russian scientists who want to pick Floyd's brain about rumors they've heard surrounding an epidemic at the Clavius moon base.
You know, this was pretty good, actually, at building suspension and intrigue.
Yeah.
That scene, like, oh, there's an epidemic. It's like,
sorry, Dr. Smith-Love, but I'm really not at liberty to discuss this.
I can't say anything about that.
Do you feel
like
it paid off?
No, that's my issue with that.
Dr. Floyd says he's not at liberty to discuss the matter.
I like that scene.
Actually, in the book, the Cold War is still a huge part of the plot, but it's completely skipped over in the film.
Yeah, I also like that in the future, they're like, oh, ladies can be scientists too. Not too many ladies, and definitely no non-white people.
Right there. More spaceflight montage on his way to the moon. At the Clavius base, Floyd thanks the resident scientists for their cooperation in the cover-up story, saying it's necessary because the public might not be ready to learn about the discovery. Floyd goes to see the discovery himself and turns out to be a black monolith, identical to the one he saw in the apes earlier. When sunlight touches the monolith, it emits an ear-splitting radio signal.
Is that the last time we see the monolith in the movie? Oh no, at the very end, the hotel scene, we see it one more time.
Huge flying one, which is what he flies into around Jupiter.
There was this really weird one-star review where they're like, so they're just like all going crazy for a big chocolate bar? You know what I do? I eat it. And like, that was the whole review. Anyway, sorry.
I didn't quite get the logistics of it. Like, they seem to imply that radio signal was emitted the first time the sunlight hits it.
But why wouldn't it have
hit it? They literally just excavated it and then got these guys like in a few minutes. Like,
I guess.
I don't think so. It's crazy.
18 months later, we pick up the story aboard the Discovery 1, a spaceship bound for Jupiter. Aboard are doctors Dave Bowman and Frank Poole, as well as three other astronauts in hibernated cybersleep. The ship is run by HAL 9000 computer that utilizes artificial intelligence. HAL tells the BBC interviewer that no 9000 computer has ever made a mistake, ever.
The 9000 series is the most reliable computer ever made. No 9000 computer has ever made a mistake or distorted information.
Dr. Bowman says Hal acts like he has genuine emotions, but notes that no one knows whether or not these emotions are real.
One day.
Wait, hold on. Were you confused by the interview where he's like, yeah, so it's like an artificial intelligence. It's like a person, but it's like, why is that linked to this discovery? Like, why don't they just interview whoever made these robots? Like, why does it have to be, why do you have to interview the people who are going to Jupiter? Do you know what I mean?
Oh, like, why wouldn't they?
Like, other 9000 HAL 9000s exist. So just interview those people, if that's really what you're interested in.
Well, so presumably these people going to Jupiter are a big deal. They mentioned like they're celebrities in their own right. And this is probably the first time that people are aware of this HAL 9000 being a thing.
I'm just saying, if you really want a story about the HAL 9000, you don't have to go to Jupiter to do it. Sounds like.
I mean, probably, yeah.
You know what else bothered me? So the shots are super cool in the round spaceship when he's doing the jogging and he jogs all the way up and down because the whole set is rotating, right? So he's like jogging up. But then they cut to a shot just head on of him running, and clearly it's not, the camera isn't moving at all. So it very clearly just looks like a giant rotating set. He just looks like he's hamster wheeling.
Oh my God. So like,
that's exactly what he's doing.
Okay, yeah.
I know it is, but it's like they just drop the illusion.
I just think you're way more clever than I am, because I was watching him. I'm like, how do they do it? And David's like, Colleen, the camera's not moving. I'm like, okay.
It was kind of the nice. I didn't think what it looked like if the camera wasn't moving and he was running.
Yeah, I totally bought it.
Even when the camera really wasn't moving and he was not upside down.
David had to like explain it to me and use his hands to like visualize how that would work.
But the shot was just a guy running flat, not upside down.
I don't know.
Okay. I mean, your mind doesn't go to the room is moving. Fair enough.
Yeah. I'm sorry that I have a suspense of, what do you call it? Suspension of disbelief. Anyway, what am I? Oh, talking about Hal.
Talking about Hal.
One day, Hal asks Dave if he's having second thoughts about the mission while admitting it's had suspicions about the strange stories coming from the moon and all the secrecy during preparations for the mission. Then Hal detects that the antenna AE-35 unit is about to go kaput. Bowman performs a spacewalk to retrieve the unit, but once aboard the ship, Poole and Bowman find nothing wrong with it. Worse, Mission Control reports back that its twin 9000 computer says the unit's just fine, and Hal is wrong. Hal chalks it up to human error.
Whoa. I also thought that was kind of a weird scene, where they, like, the first second that the two scientists think that maybe Hal's lying to them, they have to, like, do this elaborate ruse to, like, talk in secrecy, right?
Yeah.
Remember?
I think that's going to become...
Oh, well, then let's just read that first.
Paul and Bowman use an excuse to go into the EVA pod, and they secretly discuss what to do with Hal. They decide to replace the antenna unit, and if it doesn't fail, they'll have to shut down Hal's higher brain functions. Hal discovers their plan by reading their lips. When Paul goes to replace the antenna unit...
Okay, wait. So are you talking about how they get into the evac and then they turn it all the way around so that Hal can look in the window? And it's like, why didn't they just stay?
No, my question is like, so if their first thought, the second they think Hal might be just lying or wrong or incorrect, they're immediately afraid. They're immediately like, oh, we can't let him hear our secret plan now. So were they just always afraid?
Well,
they're always like, well, we'll have this AI, sure, but we are afraid. And if anything goes wrong, we're going to be afraid.
Right. So spoiler alert, eventually they just shut Hal down and the ship can run without Hal or without his executive, like, artificial intelligence. So the moment they need to hide from him, couldn't they just shut it off then?
Well, I'm saying in like the version of this movie that is just this story, you know, an hour long, just a movie about a robot that's artificial intelligence and they're killing all the astronauts, right? It would start, there's like six of them, and they'd be, one of them be like, all right, Hal, we're shutting you off right now, and you'll obviously obey me right now. And then that guy would die. And then they'd be like, okay, now we have to be secretive because we didn't think that this would just happen right away.
Do you think it's weird that they
immediately like, fuck, well, he's going to kill us, so we got to do something. That's my point.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they're seen and established that like Hal was lying to them.
It's just like they would just think it's an error. They wouldn't think it's malice.
Yeah, it is weird that they. Yeah, that is weird. Anyway. I didn't think about that.
Where are we at?
When Paul goes to replace the antenna unit, Hal takes control of the EVA pod and cuts his oxygen line. Paul drifts into the cold reaches of space, and Bowman takes another pod out to retrieve him. Hal then shuts off life support systems, killing the hibernating scientists aboard the ship.
Oh boy. Oh boy.
That was me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Bowman returns with Poole, but Hal refuses to let him back into the ship. Bowman uses the emergency airlock to sneak aboard, but in doing so, he has to let go of Dr. Poole's body. Inside the ship, Hal tries to convince Bowman that everything's okay now. He was just having a bad day and worried about the mission.
I know everything hasn't been quite right with me, but I can assure you now, very confidently, that it's going to be all right again.
Bowman shut down Hal's memory circuits one by one, effectively killing him, turning back into the ordinary machine. It's a dramatic slow death scene as Hal tries to reason with Bowman. He says, "Stop, Dave, I'm afraid," and also sings a little song.
I just thought, like, the acting of the guy who does Hal was really good.
All scene is really, really good.
It's good, but it could have been shorter. Like, it goes so long.
I mean, you're like, can we get to the hotel scene? Like, what do you want? Like, the sets are really nice. All the acting is really good. All the music is really good. It is long, but it's like, if I'm just going to watch a thing to see.
Yeah, that's a really
great
point.
This is great.
Stop, Dave. This is really dorky, but the thing that, I don't know what, I think the first time we ever watched 2001, David does this Cockney howl that makes me laugh so hard.
Let's hear it.
Well, I think the film would just be far better if we overdubbed Howl to have more of a Cockney accent.
Which would be like?
What would that be like?
I can't actually do a Cockney accent.
Ah.
You can, yeah.
No, what the fuck are you doing now? Dave. What, Dave?
Dave!
I think it was human error, Dave.
Dave, I know a song!
No, I think that would just fit really well with the vibe of 2000.
Daisy! Anyway.
Let's go, Dave!
Dave, I'm losing my fucking mind! Yeah, I think that would really fit well.
Anyway.
We're going to Jupiter, that's fucking mental, Dave! Where are we at?
At the moment of Hal's death, a video message comes onto the monitor. On it, Dr. Floyd reveals the true purpose of the mission, previously only known to Hal. He tells the crew about the moon's monolith and the signal it's sending. The signal suggests the existence of extraterrestrial life. Oh, I guess he does say that.
I don't get why there's a...
pointed at Jupiter.
Like, TV conveniently placed right next to this memory core for Hal, which turns on automatically when he gets disabled.
Very silly.
Like, yeah.
Don't worry about it.
It's like, oh, we actually have to explain this crap. Let's just
well, fuck.
Sorry.
Will I get this bit? Bowman arrives at Jupiter, where there's another monolith floating in space. We're floating, we're floating, we're floating, and what the fuck? Bowman is transported through what I assume is a very intense acid trip, a laser show meets kaleidoscope.
Oh, what I didn't like about that is that it was such a pretty shot. It's the slit scope, you know, the two colors zooming in, but it'd have to show Dave again, and he would, like, do the really pretty shot, and he'd be like, bah! You know, you have the little faces of him just, like, looking really bad.
I actually don't agree, because I like the reflection on the helmet, where it's just like he's got the crazy bug eyes, and there's the lights on his helmet, like, ah!
But it's like, I would love to have that scene on just as like a wallpaper. But then you'd be like, oh, nice. Like, no, I forgot about that.
Well, I'm surprised, like, rewatching this. They never actually show him, like, flying into the monolith.
Right, okay.
Like, he's just, like, getting in a pod, and then the next shot is like...
Oh, yeah, color time.
So after it was after the intern wrote out the end of it, I Googled and I was like, what is supposed to be happening? And they say, like, oh, he gets sucked into a Stargate and transported. And I'm like, that is not clear.
Yeah.
That is not, no, he's not going anywhere. He just is. Things happen. Mm-hmm. He appears.
Sorry, you have to be spoon fed everything.
I really
that
do.
In the film.
Tell me what the fuck the Mona Lisa is smiling about.
Why is she happy?
But not too happy.
But not too happy.
Okay, I'm not sure how much of this I got, so I assume it's a very intense acid trip, a laser show meets kaleidoscope with lava lamp flowing in, also psychedelic mountains, 9 minutes.
9 minutes of colors.
Yeah, psychedelic is such a strong, I mean, it's just, like, colored. Like, it's just filtered color images.
To be fair, it's much shorter than I remember it.
I know, I think before this movie, I'm like, there's a mountain scene that's like 20 minutes long, and it's...
I was like, oh, 9 minutes, nice.
And now he's in a pod in the stately hotel room with a light-up floor, because why not?
A light-up floor.
Yeah,
that's cool. It's odd for a fancy hotel room. Then he rapidly ages in a hotel room until he's on his deathbed and the monolith comes to visit. Then he's a creepy fetus in a suspended bubble who goes from the hotel room to circling Earth. End of the movie.
That's the movie!
Yeah. What I don't like is that the monolith in the first scene with the apes, like the apes is, you know, a 20-minute scene that's so slow, and it's the whole thing is to set up that the monolith teaches the apes how to use tools. And That's kind of cool, though, when you're like, whoa, the monolith is like advancing civilization.
Another scene that could have been 5 minutes.
But right, but then it's like
six different scenes.
That is an interesting setup and idea, but yeah. Like...
What does that have to do with the rest of the movie?
Did that ever pay off?
No. What did that have to do with the whole Hal bit? Like, how are those really connected? Like, I get that Hal has to kill them because they might get in the way of his mission, which is to get to Jupiter to address this monolith, which is similar to the monolith. Like, I get that, but it doesn't really connect that well.
And now we're going to go to our next segment. We have not warned him ahead of time. We usually do. This is called Bro Call, where we call our brother John, and he's going to tell us about the movie.
Call John Flaherty.
And he actually did watch it because he did complain to us.
He did send us some angry text messages.
So I hope he gets his call, or it's going to be all for nothing.
What if that were the case?
Oh, that'd be joyous.
Oh, boy.
Oh, please.
John Flaherty. Hey, John!
Hey, John!
You're here on Flares on Films with special guest David Padbury while we talk about his favorite movie, 2001, A Space Odyssey. John, did you see it? What did you think?
What did you like most about it?
See, here's why you already know I watched it. A, because I texted you. B, because you're laughing as you're asking.
What was your favorite bit?
David, just... be honest, are you being serious? It's your favorite movie?
Favorite. Not Gladiator, but, you know.
It's that or Gladiator.
Yeah.
Then I mean this very sincerely. Fuck you!
So, good or bad? I haven't gotten it.
I mean, here's what that movie is. It is a script that a director got and said... oh, this song sounds like a pretty good movie. Oh, a story in space with a crazy AI. Oh, interesting. How about I take this and then I stick it really far up my own ass? just way up there. Just see what comes out.
Good metaphor. So bad.
Did not like it?
Well, I would agree with that. It's one of the most pretentious films ever made.
Fuck that movie, man.
Yeah, so...
Did you watch all the way to Baby Fetus Surrounding the Earth?
Oh, I did! Oh, I did!
Have you not seen it before? That was the first time?
First time!
What was your reaction to Baby Fetus Circling the Earth?
Well, let's break down my reactions piece by piece.
I love it. So, walk us through it!
For starters, how much time goes by the movie before somebody says a freaking word?
A long time.
Minutes. 25 minutes.
25 minutes.
It is 25 minutes! Here's why I know! I freaking paused it!
Oh my god, I pause this movie a lot to time things.
Yeah.
Oh my god!
Well, how are you gonna fit in the black screen and music in the opening?
Which was 6 minutes long.
Just come here.
All I can hear is anger. I can't understand what she's saying, John.
So, when we started the movie, after we rented it, after I had a terrible trying to rent through Amazon, and that music, let's put that in air quotes, starts, and it's just a black freaking screen.
Yep.
We're like, oh, is it broken?
That's nope. My opinion.
So we fast forwarded for about 5 minutes just to make sure. Straight up its own ass. Oh my lord.
You didn't like the Hungarian orchestra screaming?
Well, that's just Strauss at the start.
Oh, okay.
Oh my
lord. The sets are cool, though.
Here's the thing. It's totally inane, LSD-powered sections, like the first 25 minutes, and then a normal movie. And then an LSD-empowered section, and then a normal movie.
Yeah.
And that, then
normal movie's all right, though.
Of lasers, followed by, what is this? Followed by Baby Fetus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what about that normal movie, huh? That's pretty good.
That's still a little slow.
Yeah. Not bad, but I mean, like, how do the parts even fit together? So after the 25 minutes of what? we're next on to the Pan Am and into the moon station, which cool sets. That was really neat. oh, maybe this movie will be worth it.
That looks so 60s.
Does, yeah.
It does look so 60s, and I'm like, all right, you know, clearly they didn't have a full handle on what space travel would be, but well done, well done.
Oh, by the way, we haven't talked about that, how, like, so everyone thought, like, oh, Pan Am, like, clearly commercial airline will develop into space travel. Like, that makes a lot more sense than crazy billionaire who calls out pedophiles on Twitter, right? Like,
they couldn't have predicted that
one. They could not have seen that coming, I think.
No, I mean, literally after 25 minutes, I'm like, wait a second. Maybe I just restarted my own calibration of how I was approaching the movie. I thought, you know what? Just ignore that whole batshit monkey crazy section. By the way, an actor definitely died to that leopard at the beginning.
Oh, yeah, there was a real leopard fight.
Did he really die?
He really jumped on an actor.
Really?
What, really?
Well, I mean, clearly the people in the monkey suits were actors.
Oh, you don't have a fact, though, that a guy died.
I assumed it was a real ape that was getting jumped on.
Is this a Ben-Hur situation?
A 100 people died!
I reset my expectations. Oh, okay, this is interesting. And then, like, the whole Russians in the moon station, how they were like, oh, okay, maybe this is a political game. Like,
didn't Catherine Hepper, like, hang out with the leopard for, like, an hour?
Yeah, you can hang out with leopards.
You can just do that.
Oh my god. Yeah, so I recalibrated, thought, okay, this is gonna be kind of a normal movie. Oh, and then the black thing and the black domino shows back up, and it's like, oh, okay, what's this? And then they just abandon
all dominoes are black.
Yeah.
No, there's white dominoes.
Are there?
Yeah.
Oh.
You're missing my point.
The characters. You can get them in neon colors.
Really?
There's no dots on there.
What connection does that entire sequence on the moon have to do with anything else in the movie?
Or what does anything else in the movie have to do with the sequence on the moon?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Again, also, this movie takes so much time to do anything.
Yeah, visual experience, John.
That was really hard for me. David, like, he's like, Colleen, we're experiencing this. Because at first I was like, maybe I'll watch it in half-hour increments to really get. He's like, no. We are watching this beginning to end. I didn't have my phone on me, so I couldn't scroll through anything while I was watching these scenes that would just go on.
I did have my phone. I would be on it for a second, like, well, I'll look up when anything happened. And I look up like an hour later, like, nothing's happening? Oh, okay.
It was, what, a five-minute scene for them to literally go into the shuttle?
Yeah, it was a literally 5 minutes to
but
dock.
That's probably one of the best parts, you know.
It is really beautiful.
For the shuttle. Fly the shuttle. Flying the shuttle. No words. Nothing going on. Flying the shuttle. Check
yeah.
The watch.
Fly it's called economical shuttle. Use of your set.
Wow. I mean, the models were cool. That was nice. But Jesus
the music
Christ,
was good,
get
too.
On with mm-hmm. it.
So,
oh, my Lord. Then, yeah. That we're going to Jupiter. No context from what before. Just implications.
Isn't it cool
real?
That we knew what Jupiter looked like in the 1960s?
Yeah, it is cool. It's neat. So the entire HAL plot line, cool.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
That should have been the movie.
Yeah.
Just the bit with Jupiter.
Yeah.
That's it. Everything before and everything after. Cut that crap.
Even the hotel scene?
Yeah, John, did you see the light up floor?
Yeah.
Do you see how he was a young man and then an old man, but he was seeing his old man himself across the room,
it's
and then
like
he was
how,
a dying old man?
And then he broke a glass.
It's like how aliens are old or something. I don't know.
Remember when he slowly dropped a glass and it broke on the floor and then he was dying?
Watch this movie. Literally, Stanley Kubrick should mail drugs to anyone who has the audacity to watch this movie because they deserve it.
Oh.
I think most people brought their own.
And I know they were purposely ambiguous about you know, the
ambiguous.
Ambiguous about why Hal betrayed them. But fuck you for doing that. Fuck you. Of course you were ambiguous because anyone can derive meaning. Yeah, I'm sure that's what they're saying.
Yeah.
John, back me up on that. That felt like what they were
John,
saying.
John, do you have any final thoughts?
I feel I'm hammering the same theme over and over again, but let me just reiterate one more time, just to sum up for the entire crowd. Fuck this movie.
What would you grade it, do you think?
I'm going to go with a D. And you know why I'm going to go with a D?
Why?
Tell us.
Dave. Dave. I'm giving it a D, Dave.
Oh, good bit.
That was a really fun bit. John.
That's totally why it's David's favorite movie, by the way.
John, thank you so much for joining us.
That was a burn, Padbury.
We'll talk to you later. Bye. Was it a burn?
Anyway.
Was that insult that his name starts with?
That was a great segment. Now we're going to all give it our own grades. David, you go first. What do you grade this movie?
Well, I really like it. So
mm-hmm. That's, yeah, letter grade.
A, for sure.
A for sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Confident.
Wow. So I'm going to give it a surprisingly high grade just because, you know, it's like obvious why it's on the AFI, blah, blah, blah. C minus.
That's probably my grade. Again, I had great expectations going into the movie. It's like, oh, it's long and it's just nice to look at. It is nice to look at, I think. Even the silly monkeys. I mean, they don't look realistic, but it's like, it's still fun to kind of look at.
Yeah.
And they're moving around and they're making noise and they're having a good time, you know.
Right. It's not like Nashville.
They're hitting each other with bones. It's fun.
It's not like, oh, I'm watching a shitty film. That's also boring.
The sets are really good. I like all the music a lot. The acting.
You're kind of a classical music guy.
It's too strong. But the acting is good. Baby, you just see it and you laugh because that's so dumb. It's just really, really stupid. So, but I'll give it a C-.
Because
it's not like a good film.
Michael, who are we sponsored by this week?
Let me open up my computer again to see. Tesla.
Tesla, if you want.
Like, what do they do?
Oh, I'm so glad
you asked. Do they do like what could the consumer products that I could buy? So not cars. Or are they all cars?
All cars.
I thought he did like other stuff.
Well, he has Elon Musk has other
but Tesla is just cars.
David, is Tesla just cars?
Well, more interestingly, they make batteries, which the
batteries
the idea is they'll start storing a lot of energy for solar power, which will actually be quite a thing in itself.
It's weird that they gave us such ambiguous copy.
You imagine they have Tesla accessories too, so like dashboard dice.
Well, it was that boring company, the tunnel one he's got, that they started selling flamethrowers and things, which are a bit more affordable.
More affordable than a Tesla.
Doesn't sound like we can buy any Tesla things, though.
We're also sponsored this week by Alexa.
Yeah, if y'all want to have a slave robot that won't kill you, get Alexa. That's just the official copy. I'll improvise something next time. Anyway... Thank you so much. Dave, thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, it was very welcome.
Audience, thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week with...
Psycho!
Psycho!
That's in the movie,
That's the bit from it. And cut.